From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and thanks for joining us during our fall membership drive. We begin today with the news that Stan Lee has died. The comic book writer and editor whose superhero creations included the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Hulk, Iron Man, the X-Men, and the Avengers was 95.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches seeds just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
Bob Batchelor teaches communications at Miami University, Ohio. He's the author of the book, Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel. When we spoke this afternoon, we started with how Lee changed superheroes in comics.
Well, in the early 50s, a bunch of social psychologists and legislators went after comic books because they believed that comic books were leading to juvenile delinquency. And so the state of comic books was really kind of sad. At that point, Stan, like many other people, had to really scramble to keep his job, and comic books moved completely away from superheroes. So most publishers were doing war stories and animal funny stories and even romance books. They really couldn't sell superheroes or anything really that might contribute to the juvenile delinquency idea. What Stan was able to do was bridge that and luckily stick around in the comic books industry during some dark days so that he could get to the point where he felt that superheroes were able to be brought back to the mainstream.
And one of the things that he did is that his superheroes felt like real people. They had personal problems. They struggled with their emotions. They weren't necessarily perfect. And the novelist Michael Chabon said that consequently, I'm quoting Michael now, everything that works in comic books today is indebted to him for that, unquote. Why did Stan Lee feel that was important, and how was that a change from what had come before?
Stan was used to reading comic books and growing up in an era in which comic book superheroes sounded maybe more like politicians or religious leaders or other authority figures. And when Stan finally had the power and the influence at Marvel, when he was really editor-in-chief and art director, he decided superheroes should sound just like you or I. And the readership just exploded. First with the Fantastic Four, which was like everybody's family. You had your grumpy old Uncle Ben. You had your beautiful sister or aunt in Sue Storm, your intellectual uncle. He brought these people into American homes, and they fought just like regular people. And then when with Spider-Man, it's just pure genius, because in creating a superhero teenager, he gave that teenager angst, and he gave that teenager a real voice at a time when the baby boom population was exploding. And so they're looking for heroes, and Spider-Man becomes this really cool superhero that talks just like them and has the same problems that they have. And so this is really one of Stan's great legacies. Michael Chabon is right on point whenever he talks about the power of Stan's human characters and the influence they had on popular culture. We see it today with the Robert Downey Jr. depiction of Iron Man.
The movie studios now look at superheroes as a business proposition. They are going to spend as much as $500 million on making and marketing a superhero film. They're going to get merchandise, theme park rides, sequels, TV shows, who knows what. And obviously, Stan Lee is working in a business. He's publishing comics. Did he think there was some reason why superheroes needed to exist beyond generating profits?
Stan was a great humanitarian, and he deeply felt this idea that we should judge people and we should act toward people as human being to human being. And I think that this grew out of his really rough upbringing during the Great Depression in the slums of New York City. It made him really human, and it made him interested in other human beings and other people. And so what I think is that Stan saw something in the superhero narrative from his own youth, watching, you know, early films or listening to dramas on the radio. He saw something amazing in the human story of superheroes and really wanted to bring that to life.
Well, he said many years ago that if Marvel created its own programming like Disney, I'm quoting from your own book now, that its superheroes would rival Walt's famous Mouse and Princesses. And yet, even though he had that idea, and I think we take Marvel or any kind of superhero movie for granted now, it was not easy to get these movies made. Marvel had huge financial problems.
What happened is that Hollywood at the time was just too conservative. Stan could get meetings with anybody because people grew up reading comic books. They wanted to meet the great Stan Lee. But it was getting movie producers and movie studios to actually sign off on the projects. So Stan worked for decades, really put his career as a writer and editor on hold, and went an entirely different direction, moved from New York to California, set up Marvel Studios, and just kept banging on doors. His archives at the University of Wyoming are filled with letters to studio heads and different star actors who he really wanted to bring into the superhero franchise, but he just couldn't get anybody to sign off. I mean, even Jim Cameron couldn't get a Marvel movie made. So that tells you the level of fear that Hollywood had for this idea that superheroes would sell. And so Stan's vision really is instrumental, and the power and the class that he brought to that diplomacy that he had to do with the studios to finally get them to sign off on making Marvel films.
There's a cliche of dialogue in superhero films: with great power comes great responsibility. Where did Stan see his responsibility?
Stan Lee was the ultimate Marvel comic book fan, and he was also the ultimate hero to the fans. People loved Stan Lee. They loved seeing him. They loved interacting with him. And that didn't just happen because the Marvel movies became popular. Stan put the effort in. In the 1970s, he was out on the road lecturing at college campuses, sometimes up to three times a week. He did that for years. And he went to comic conventions, and he gave himself to the fans, and they responded. And this is the kind of thing that doesn't happen with celebrities without that celebrity being genuine and authentic. And Stan Lee defined genuine and authentic for today's comic book fans, for today's popular culture fans, for anybody interested in the superhero narrative or popular culture at large.
Bob Batchelor is a visiting professor at Miami University, Ohio. He's also the author of the book, Stan Lee, The Man Behind Marvel. Bob, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher collaborates with military veterans for her latest album.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, Justin Sayer, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to the special Pledge Drive edition of The Frame. I'm John Horn. On this Veterans Day, we're going to revisit a story that was produced for The Frame earlier this year by KPCC Veteran Affairs reporter Libby Dankman. She profiled award-winning singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. Gaucher brought military veterans and their families into the writing process for her latest album called Rifles and Rosary Beads. NPR music critic Ann Powers says Gaucher's album is, quote, the product of compassion and a call for more compassion at a time when it's needed most. Libby Dankman spoke with Gaucher and with a wounded service member who says their collaboration helped heal the invisible injuries of war.
Joshua Gertz joined the Army after high school. He had some uncles who served, and he thought college wasn't for him. That was 1999. Fast forward a few years to Gertz driving a truck on his last night of deployment in Iraq.
My vehicle was hit with a roadside bomb, which left me with brain injury and some spinal cord damage. I'm not wheelchair bound, but it makes things difficult.
It was the psychological wounds that nearly killed Gertz. At one point, after returning home to his wife, Lisa, and two sons in New York, he attempted suicide.
I felt like I was a burden, and it was almost like I wanted my family to be able to laugh again.
Lisa was looking for help when she came across a news article about a nonprofit that pairs veterans with professional songwriters.
Knowing my love for music, she thought it would be something that I would maybe go to.
Rifles and rosary beads, you hold on.
Gertz grew up near Buffalo in a musical family, but he'd never written a song before. And that's common, says Nashville singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. She's been volunteering as a mentor with Songwriting with Soldiers for about 5 years. The organization holds several retreats a year all over the country. Each veteran produces a song by the end of the weekend. It's free to service members and their partners. Here's Mary Gaucher.
Soldiers are trained not to be vulnerable, but when they come home, they've got to learn it. And part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable. But that's what songs do.
War with my baby from my breast. Now my name in rank.
This year, Gaucher released an entire album co-written with military veterans from the program. The 11 tracks on Rifles and Rosary Beads dig deep into the veteran experience, including stories you may not typically associate with military service. The song Brothers takes listeners to the emotional deployment of a new mom.
Why my face changed my soaking bra, told my body not to feel at all, tried to be like you, what must I do to prove that I'm a brother too?
I learned a lot writing with Megan Cunahan and Brittany Fadd. Being the first generation of females in combat. And the mantra that they had to deal with is no special treatment.
Another track was co-written with half a dozen military wives and songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman, who wrote the monster hit This Kiss for Faith Hill.
Beth and I sat with the wives, and they started to talk about what they called the war after the war.
There's landmines in the living room, and eggshells on the floor. I lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain.
They have to serve in silence a lot of the time. And our veterans have told me over and over again, look, the hero here is my wife.
Invisible. The war after the war.
You know, Leonard Cohen said it best, the crack is how the light gets in. We don't connect at our strengths. We connect at our vulnerabilities.
On the first night of the retreat, Josh Gertz came in skeptical. But Gaucher's vulnerable performance convinced him she would be a reliable songwriting partner.
It was just something about her words, being able to express so many complex feelings with such a simple way of saying it.
So they started talking, Gaucher looking for a way to uncover his song.
She said, so, you know, looking back on it, What do you think that one thing that's kind of weighing you down is? And so, I don't know, who the hell knows?
Looking back now, who the hell knows where the soul of a dead soldier goes?
I was just blown away that it could be that simple. And then once I started opening up and being truly honest with her, I think Mary saw where the true hurt, my true pain was coming from.
That song became Still on the Ride. Instead of dwelling on his own life-changing injuries, Gertz chose to memorialize a fallen friend. Thomas Falk died November 7th, 2000, just before their one-year anniversary in the Army.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I mean, we spent pretty much every second of every day together since the day we joined the Army, and he was family.
My eyes. Me and my guardian angel were still on the ride.
I shouldn't be here. Why him and not me? With all that, I should be the one. And I think from that kind of stemmed the idea that maybe he went first to be my guardian angel and make sure I made it through those things.
Double vision and my stomach's in my...
Gertz says he works every day to maintain his mental health. He's played harmonica on stage with Mary Gaucher on her Rifles and Rosary Beads tour, and he credits songwriting with soldiers with helping him open up and trust someone else with his story.
It's always going to be there. You just have better training, better tools to deal with it, and more support to deal with it.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone.
For The Frame, I'm Libby Denkman.
But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
And we close today with this. The devastating fires in Los Angeles and Ventura counties have taken their toll on Hollywood. The western town at Paramount Ranch in Agoura Hills, which has been used as a location for 90 years, has been lost to the fire. Rebecca Keegan of The Hollywood Reporter was on KPCC's Take Two this morning, and she provided some background on the location that has been widely used for westerns.
The ranch at Western Town was built in 1927 as a set for cowboy movies, and it had everything you'd expect to see for those films: a saloon, a jail, a train depot, dusty streets designed for dueling. Most recently, it provided some of the sets for the HBO show Westworld. Clint Eastwood shot parts of American Sniper there. In the 90s, they shot the TV show Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. So it's really a well-used set.
Westworld is not currently in production for its third season, and Paramount Ranch was not the HBO series' primary location. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening, and thank you so much for supporting KPCC during our fall membership drive.